This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Suspected killer husband Brian Walsh twists and turns in court as his wife's lover takes the stand. The jury brings down the hammer. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us. A Massachusetts father of three stands trial for his wife, Anna Walsh's alleged murder. And while he's sitting there, groomed perfectly, flanked by a phalanx of attorneys, his wife's lover takes the stand. That's right, Brian Walsh, accused of murdering and dismembering his wife, Anna, the mother of his children, got to sit by and listen to her lover on the stand. Now, listen to this. And you can't really blame the defense attorney. What did he have to work with? During opening statements, defense attorney said Brian Walsh found his wife dead in bed on New Year's Day, then panicked, lied to police as they investigated her disappearance, but swore he didn't kill her. Okay, so he finds her dead and didn't call 911. He decided it was a better idea to dismember her and get rid of her body. Okay. Jurors also heard testimony from a man who was Anna Walsh's lover on the stand, as well as a voicemail Brian Walsh left the guy the day she, Anna, was reported missing. His name, William Fastow, real estate broker in D.C., met Anna while she was looking for a home in D.C., and he helped her buy a townhouse. Now, remember, her husband, Brian Walsh, was on house arrest because he's an art con selling fake Andy Warhols. So I guess anybody but him looked pretty attractive to her. Yeah, my husband's on house arrest at home, not making a living, not attractive. You know, I'm telling you this much. I get up and go to work every day, and I expect David Lynch to get up and go to work every day, too, and he does. Plus, don't be jealous, ladies. He empties the trash and cleans up after I cook. So, you know, that said, that's a high standard. Brian Walsh just laid around the house. Why? Because he was a con and got sentenced to house arrest. Fastow, the lover, says Anna was despondent and sad because she was away from her children so much, but she had to be to make a living because her husband had home confinement. She was deeply upset that she was not in a position to be the mother to her children she wanted to be because of her husband. What happened to Anna Walsh?
New tonight, police are asking the public to help them find a Cohasset, Massachusetts mother of three who vanished without a trace on New Year's Day. 39-year-old Anna Walsh left her home early Sunday morning. She was supposed to take a flight from Logan to D.C. where she works during the week, but there's no record of her ever boarding a flight. Police say there's been reports that she took a ride share, but investigators haven't been able to confirm that.
3 days after she was seen leaving her home with bags in hand, Walsh was reported missing.
We cannot confirm that she actually got into a ride share in Cohasset. We can further, we have confirmed with the airlines, and that's been a challenge, that she did not board a plane this week.
Police say her phone has been off and there has been no activity on her credit or debit cards.
Just a loving wife and mother to, she always says, three beautiful boys who she loves so much.
Three little boys wondering, where is mommy? You are hearing our friends at WPRI and WUSA. So where's Anna? Now, I had to take that exact flight very often. And between New York and Boston and D.C., it's almost a triangle of hourly flights. With me, an all-star panel to make sense of what we know right now. But first, I want to go to Bob Ward, reporter for Boston 25 News. You can find him at Twitter at BWard3. Bob, thank you for being with us. Could you just verbalize that a little bit better than I did? I mean, I know out of
in New York, I would very often have to race from Court TV to get to the Marine Air Terminal at LaGuardia, a different terminal than the main LaGuardia terminal, because they had hourly flights not only to Atlanta, but to D.C., where I would go to shoot Larry King. And believe it or not, they were so regular, almost like a bus, for Pete's sake, I could be there within 2 hours of leaving the studios in Manhattan. It was amazing. But there's so many flights out of Logan to New York and D.C., that's a lot of investigation to find out if she really did get on a plane.
Right. But, you know, Nancy, right from the very beginning, this sounded odd, because you're talking, this was New Year's Day. This was first thing in the morning on New Year's Day. She had a party at her house that went until about 1 o'clock in the morning, New Year's Eve into New Year's Day. A mother of three who claimed there was an emergency at her realty firm in Washington, D.C.
Okay, wait. Let me stop you right there. Bob Ward is joining me from Boston 25 News. I'm drinking out of the fire hydrant from you, Bob Ward. You're giving me so much information so quickly. So
right.
With the three children, she was actually working in D.C., living
right.
in the Boston area. And what was her job in D.C.? Was it a new job?
It was a fairly new job. You know, we're still trying to unpack some of this stuff, but she had a job with an apartment down in D.C.
Okay, wait, what was her job in D.C.?
I'm not clear on what her job was. She was not a realtor, but she was some kind of property manager.
That's it. That's what it was, property manager. And hold on
right.
just a moment. We all know about getting a new job. You feel like you've got to do whatever they want to make
right.
that great impression so they don't say, wow, we've got her on 6 months probation. We're going to can her. She's not doing a very good job. I mean,
right.
David Studdard is with me right now, guys. Now, I think of David Studdard as a motorman, as an APD, Atlanta Police Department officer, but now he is a very well-known lawyer. David Studdard, do you remember your first day on the job as a cop?
Absolutely, I do.
And?
It was a long time ago, 1988.
And?
I do remember my first day, and I was super excited, super enthusiastic, and just wanting to get out and save the world.
And didn't want to screw anything up and land at some desk assignment.
That's right. We were on a very strict 6-month probationary period when we first started there, and any infraction would cause you some difficulty right quick. So to your point, absolutely. I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to get through that probationary period.
And then you put yourself through law school. Can you remember your first day working as a lawyer? You're like,
yep.
Man, I hope I don't screw this up. This is nothing like being a cop.
That's absolutely right. The same sort of feeling.
I mean, Karen Stark, you remember you would be with me on the set at Court TV. Karen Stark is with me, a renowned psychologist joining us out of the Manhattan jurisdiction. She's at KarenStark.com, Karen with a C. Karen, you'd be with me on the set at Court TV, and my stomach will be churning to figure out if I can make that flight to get to Larry King's studios in Washington to get on the air, you know, and I would make it. I don't think I ever did not make it. But when you've got a new gig, you'll do anything. And if they told me, hey, you got to fly to D.C. to be on tonight, I go, sure, I can't wait. Just like this woman, they go, hey, you got to fly down to D.C. We got an emergency. I don't care if it's New Year's Day. And she would hop that plane. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with it, Nancy. And I remember those days like it was yesterday. And you were always doing above and beyond what you needed to do. I used to watch you on Larry King because I couldn't believe that you would make it. And you always made it. But what pressure.
Yeah, there were a lot of white knuckles in a cab trying to get to LaGuardia Marine.
Yes.
So we're hearing from Bob Ward that something wasn't right, but yet it was a new job. So people chalked it off. Well, you know, she's proving herself. But then things even went more sideways. Take a listen to our friends at Boston 25.
A Cohasset police log is shedding new light on how the investigation first got started. It says a call requesting a well-being check was made on January 4th by a man who identified himself as the head of security at Honor Walsh's employer in D.C., Tishman Speyer. The log says Tishman Speyer contacted husband Brian Walsh before he reported his wife missing. It explains that he told police Anna left for D.C. and he hadn't heard from her since. According to the log, Anna's phone phone last pinged on January 2nd at 3:14 a.m. in Cohasset and hit the tower on Reservoir Road in Cohasset, less than a mile from the family's home.
Okay, with me, very well-known PI, private investigator, Tom Ruskin is with us. Ruskin is president of CMP Protective and Investigative Group, Inc., former NYPD investigator, and you can find him at cmp-group.com. Tom Ruskin, I don't like it when it's your job calling to report you missing, not your family.
Correct. I mean, this stinks to the high heavens. It really does. Not to mention that it is a lot easier now than when I joined the force before my colleague in 1982 to check flight records, to check TSA records, to check different airlines. There's only a certain number of airlines that would fly between her home and Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for the TSA and Homeland Security to go into those records now and search for her name, her date of birth, and see if she, A, had a plane reservation, B, did she clear security with all the cameras that are in airports, and C, did she actually get on the flight?
Can I tell you something, Tom Ruskin? That's an excellent point I hadn't even thought of, because I remember going, and you'll laugh at this, Stoddard, going to the Greyhound bus station in inner city Atlanta, trying to find out if a particular woman, who always and to this day is still a Jane Doe, by the way, who was murdered, if she had gotten off of a Greyhound bus before she was murdered by whom I believe to be a serial killer. Don't worry, I got him on one. But it was so hard to do, Tom.
Nancy, you'll also remember when you ran from Court TV to the Marine Air Terminal at LaGuardia Airport, you used to be able to run through, no magnetometers. Oh, yeah. You'd run on a Delta flight or People's Express flight or Eastern back then, and you just jump on the flight with a random ticket that you could any hour. Nowadays, you can't do that.
Oh, no. TSA, man, they got to justify their existence. And so they will do a full-on body cavity search if they feel like it. It doesn't matter who you are. You know who gets searched the most? My mother, going in with a wheelchair when we push her around the airport, even though she can walk. But, yeah. They love to hone in on my mom, Elizabeth. That said, you're right, Tom Ruskin. There's only a couple of carriers that go between Boston and D.C.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
The lover, Fastow, testified the fraud case against Brian Walsh was a, quote, big stressor in Anna's marriage. And it felt like he was ruining, and she felt like it was ruining her and the children's life. He testified that Anna and Walsh had a, quote, heated argument over credit card charges. She told him, Brian Walsh, sitting on his rear end on the sofa not working, had spent thousands for a sports memorabilia business. I would have done a backflip. What do we know about the evidence regarding her murder?
The employer is reporting Anna missing, not her family. But listen to this, WBZ.
WBZ has obtained and verified audio of a voicemail left by Mr. Walsh for one of Anna's friends. It's the same day Anna was reported missing to police.
Good afternoon. It's Brian Walsh. I hope all is going well. I was just reaching out to basically everybody I could. Anna hasn't been in touch for a few days. Do you know anyone that might have that contact with her? Calling everyone. So sorry to bother you. Sure, everything's fine.
So we do see the husband reaching out to her friends and leaving voicemails for all of them, trying to find out if they had heard from Anna. And joining right now, Julie Lewis, president and CEO of Digital Mountain, Inc. at digitalmountain.com. Julie, thank you for being with us. Tom Ruskin, the PI, points out how much easier it is to check flight records through TSA and even getting subpoenas very quickly, or asking the carrier, you know, like Delta, to check their records to find out if somebody made a flight. So, according to police, she didn't make that flight. But what, Julie Lewis, about rideshare, Lyft, Uber, and all the others? Digitally, wouldn't that leave a trail if she had taken a rideshare to the airport?
Yeah, you can certainly contact the custodian of records at the Ubers, the Lyfts, and types of companies that she would have taken a rideshare and find out that information with legal due process and see what, you know, what the actual fact pattern is there.
Well, what about her phone? I mean, most people get their rideshare through their phone app.
If you have if you have access to her phone and you knew the whereabouts of that phone, you would have access to the app, but most of that data would be stored in the cloud and pointing up to the Uber application. It might not be stored on the local phone. So that's something to consider.
Got a question for you, Julie Lewis. If we don't have her phone, but we do have her code, say it's like everybody else in America, their birthday or their children's birthday, and we have the code for her phone, can we get into the iCloud that way?
Typically, you would need the username. You would need a password for the account. And you would also, if they have multi-factor authentication turned on, from the text message.
So it's a little harder than I thought. But you know what? We're talking about her phone and where is she? Where is the husband during all of this? Take a listen to our cut 35. Lynn Beeland talking.
And you indicated on January 1st at 3 p.m. he did some errands and he went to his mother's house in Swampscott, but got lost because he didn't have his phone. He said he knew he was lost when he saw a pirate ship on Route 1. Defendant stayed 15 minutes, then went to Whole Foods and CVS. Surveillance was checked and he did not enter either of those stores.
Okay. Bob Ward, Boston 25 on this, the disappearance of Anna Walsh. Since the beginning, saw a pirate ship on Route 1. What?
Right.
Okay, now wait a minute. Wait. So
right.
He says, the husband says, he's going to visit his mother and he gets lost on the way to his mom's home. And when he sees a pirate ship, he knows he's lost. But then goes into Whole Foods and CVS, even though he's lost. What?
The pirate ship is a landmark up on the Route 1 area. There's that area of Swampscott where his mother lives. There are some old landmarks, miniature golf places, restaurants, that sort of thing. And I think that's what it was that he's talking about, was a landmark that he saw that told him where he was. And he said he got lost because he didn't have the GPS on his phone with him because he left it at home.
You know, Karen Stark, I find that very unusual. I've told my twins it's like the wizards and their wands in Harry Potter. You don't go anywhere without it. Why? Doesn't make sense to me he didn't have a cell phone, especially if he hasn't heard from his wife. Wouldn't you keep your cell phone with you at that time in case she called?
Well, let's think about this, Nancy. How many people really leave home these days without their phone? It's improbable. I have trouble believing that he accidentally left it home. And he knows that he's being watched, it seems to me. So he intentionally left that phone home. I have no doubt about it. He's the nefarious character. He knows exactly what he's doing.
In the search for Anna Walsh, local authorities find something very unusual. Take a listen to our cut 40.
Data from his phone also tracked his whereabouts on January 3rd. Locations were traveled at 4:27 on January 3rd to an apartment complex in Abington. Surveillance shows the defendant's Volvo, as well as a male fitting the defendant's appearance, exit a car near the dumpster. He walks to the dumpster carrying a garbage bag. He's leaning, and it appears to be heavy as he has to heft it into the dumpster. He walks to the dumpster with the garbage bag and leaves it. On 4:48, he hit another complex in Abington, and at 5:10 p.m., cell phone shows records at another apartment in Brockton. video shows of Heidi consistent with his appearance and his Volvo. Again, he discarded items in the dumpster.
Bob Ward joining us from Boston 25 on Anna's disappearance from the very beginning. I don't have a problem with my husband throwing trash out there in the dumpster outside our house. But when he starts going from one dumpster to the next dumpster to the next dumpster to the next dumpster, all in within a 1 hour period, that concerns me. And you know who it reminds me of? And you're going to know this name very well. Jennifer Dulos, the missing Connecticut mom of five. Right. Remember her husband, Fotis Dulos, and his mistress? They're going all around town dropping off items, and they're caught on surveillance video. Why is it, Bob Ward, maybe you can shed some light on this, why is it that when a woman goes missing, her husband suddenly turns into a neatnik and he has to throw out the trash?
Good question, Nancy. I think we know the answer to that, and that's the allegation here that sadly, that January 3rd incident that you just played the cut from, the dumpsters in the South Shore in Abington and Brockton. What we're going to find out in court, that is when the remains of Anna Walsh are being discarded in those dumpsters. Those dumpsters eventually are brought to an incinerator in the South Shore of Massachusetts. And within an hour of those dumpsters being brought to that incinerator, they're destroyed. Anna Walsh's remains have never been located. And the thought is that they never will be, because that's where those bags were brought. The other trash bags that were recovered in this case were brought to the North Shore near that pirate ship that we just talked about. And they were not brought to an incinerator, but to a landfill. They were found. And it's inside, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of us, but inside those trash bags is where the evidence, the incriminating evidence, has been located in this case.
Bob Ward, could you tell me everything you just said one more time and very slowly?
Sure.
I think the gist is that very quickly after husband Brian Walsh visited these various dumpsters, the dumpsters were cleaned out, where the trash was picked up taken, some to an incinerator and some to the pirate ship. Wait. Hold on. Wait a minute. Karen Stark, have you ever noticed how defendants weave in a tiny bit of truth into their big fat lie? The pirate ship.
I mean, that's what makes pathological liars so interesting, Nancy, is because it's usually based on a hint of truth, right? Like no smoke without fire. There's a little bit of smoke, but the rest of it, they conjure up. And they're very adept at being able to tell a lie that has a little bit of truth in it, but a lot of falsehood.
I like the verb you used, conjure. I like a magician or a wizard, because one moment Anna Walsh is there with witnesses at a New Year's Eve party, and the next moment, she's gone. Bob Ward joining me, investigative reporter, Boston 25. Tell me again what you just said.
So on January 3rd, Brian Walsh, according to the prosecutors, is recorded on surveillance trying to dump trash bags into dumpsters in the South Shore of Boston, in the towns of Abington and Brockton. The prosecution believes that those trash bags that he was struggling with to get into the dumpsters contained the dismembered remains of his wife, Anna Walsh. Shortly after he did that, those dumpsters were brought to an incinerator in the South Shore. Within an hour of those trash bags arriving at that incinerator, they were incinerated and converted into electricity. And Anna Walsh's remains have never been found. It's an absolutely horrific and gruesome part of this case. The other half of it is that Brian Walsh did not discard of all the evidence in the case on the South Shore. The allegation is that he took his tools, the instruments that he used to dismember his wife's body, along with some of her clothes and belongings, and put them in other trash bags and discarded those things in dumpsters on the North Shore of Boston near his mother's house, near that pirate ship. Those trash bags have been recovered. And those items are going to be an important part of this case and this trial when it takes place.
And what do you believe, Bob Ward, were in those trash bags?
In January, what we've been told was that they found a hatchet, a hacksaw. They found a bloody rug. They found Anna's Prada purse. They found the boots that she was seen wearing at that New Year's Eve party. And, Nancy, they found her COVID-19 card. It's absolutely stunning what they found.
Joining me, former APD Atlanta Police Department officer and now lawyer. What rank did you get to, Studdard?
I left as an investigator. Nancy, I was a homicide detective when I left.
Okay. David, have you ever had a case without a body, a homicide without a body?
Yes, I have.
Can I just say that's a tough pill to swallow?
It is. But fortunately, even in those cases, and this guy, look, you know, as a homicide detective, I would have been looking at this guy immediately simply based on the fact that his wife gets on an airplane. She's apparently overdue. He hasn't heard from her in 3 days. Only after he is contacted by her employer does he make an outcry about his wife. My wife gets on an airplane. She travels frequently. If I haven't heard from her a few minutes after she's supposed to touch down, I get frantic. I mean, I'm calling every, you know, trying to call her and call her. This guy has done nothing but, he's like a magnet for suspicion. I mean, he's going out, he's talking about this pirate ship, you know, not to mention all of this physical evidence that's located, which to my point is, you know, even the most careful criminals, when they commit these kinds of crimes, it's almost impossible to do it without leaving some sort of forensic physical evidence behind. And this guy has left a mountain of it.
I mean, could you? Here's another thing. Julie Lewis, I want to circle back to you in just a moment about possible nav systems on his car. But Tom Ruskin joining me, and then I want Karen Stark to weigh in on this as well. Tom Ruskin, guys, private investigator extraordinaire, president of CMP Protective and Investigative Group. Tom, listen, I don't like jewelry. I really don't like fancy clothes. I don't like fancy cars. But if you were to take, let's just say, this little ring right here, this is made of my mother-in-law's jewelry, okay? It's very thin. It's not bejeweled. But if you were to take that, I would come after you, all right? There are just some things that would matter to me. And I've got a funny feeling this woman would not want her fancy boots and her Prada purse thrown out.
No. And it would be weird if she had left and left for a business trip, if she didn't take those with her, that they wouldn't be behind in the house and be discoverable. This guy is definitely the prime suspect and probably will be convicted at trial. The fact of the matter is, to the other gentleman's point, you don't need a body anymore to prove a case.
It sure helps, though, man. Come on, Ruskin. I mean, yeah, you don't need a body. I'm not going to give him a gold star for getting rid of the body. And again, he hasn't been proven guilty. We're just hypothesizing on the evidence that we have. But it sure as heck helps if you do have a dead body to prove a murder case.
But it also goes against him because we know that he was in these yards. He was dumping stuff. What is he doing dumping her garbage? What's the matter? His pickup's not working at his house?
Karen Stark, he's so right. And Karen, again, I threw this to Studdard earlier, I think, but why do guys turn into neatniks as soon as their wives disappear? And again, like Studdard said, and like Ruskin is saying about the trash, it defies the course of normal human conduct. He doesn't check on his wife to see if she landed. Her employer has to call looking for her. And then he wants to take out the trash. Fine. Do it at the corner, at the end of the driveway, or the trash chute in your apartment in Manhattan. But why do you go to 5 or 6 different dumpsters? And could somebody just surprise me once and not throw bloody rags and towels in a dumpster? Do something different.
What always happens, Nancy, he believes he's not going to get caught. And this looks suspicious, so suspicious. I mean, he gets lost going to his mother.
He didn't get lost. He's trying to explain his circuitous route from one dump to the next.
And also saying that he went to places where they could check and he did not go.
So, Nancy, can I jump in for one sec?
Yes.
I just want to bring up the fact. This is a woman. Let's assume that the husband has nothing to do with her murder. This is a woman who's going to take a flight, supposedly, from Boston to Washington on a business trip. Why is her phone off? No one that travels, myself, my loved ones, my family, when we go to the airport, you shut off your phone once you're on the flight, and you turn it on, to Mr. Stoddard's point, once you land. Why is she becoming all of a sudden surreptitious or becoming covert in her actions,
you're right,
which sort of defies the logic of the husband?
Tom Ruskin, private investigator, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't guess any of you people on this panel have read Don't Be a Victim, written by, what's that girl's name? Nancy Grace. You're supposed to, like, take a picture of when you're in the parking deck, which I do, and send to my family. And then when I get on the plane, I take a picture, I'm on the plane, and send to them. You don't even have to write a text or write words, but just let people know where you're going. And Jackie, I think I've even sent them to you before.
You have.
Yes, I have. Okay, guys. That's not the end of it, but I want to ask Julie Lewis something, president and CEO of Digital Mountain, Inc. Julie, what about, I like to just say OnStar as a blanket nav description. Wouldn't his car show everywhere he had been if it were, you know, anything older than 2010?
So before I jump into that, you were talking about pictures, and there was supposedly a picture she photographed of herself with her wedding ring off. And some of her final photos. And so within that picture, there's things called EXIF data that you can look for that potentially could have geolocation information about where she was when the picture was taken.
See, that is why you're the expert. I didn't even catch that, Julie Lewis.
So switching gears to the car, you know, the car is a moving computer these days on most cars. With Wi-Fi, it has GPS. It has a cell network, all these things that you can use for tracking. So if Brian's car has that in it, law enforcement could have certainly used that information. The other thing that happens in cars is a lot of people sync their phones. And so text messages, contacts, you know, browser history, all these things may be on that, on the car. Now, you know, for example, if you rent a car, even that information can be on that. So that's something that's really important to note.
You mean when you charge your phone in a car, the car can track everything that you have written on your phone during that time?
It could be thinking like when you are in an Uber, your playlist, depending on the configuration, it could actually download that. So you don't want to go in some stranger's car, or rental car. And plug it in because the car infotainment system could be grabbing and capturing some information from your phone.
Good to know.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
The lover also testifies their relationship was hidden from Anna's husband, but it was serious, and they were planning to travel abroad together. Anna wanted to tell Brian about the relationship. The two were supposed to have dinner to discuss their future together on January 4, but he never heard from her. What happened between Christmas and January the 4th?
Take a listen to our cut 36. This is Lynn Beelan talking.
On January 1st, defendant Googled using her son's iPad. Some of the searches are as follows. Keep in mind that the defendant said he left at 6 a.m. At 4:55 a.m. on January 1st, he searched how long before a body starts to smell.
How long before a body starts to smell? Okay, keep going.
8 a.m. How to stop a body from decomposing. At 5:20 a.m., he searched how to embalm a body. At 5:47 a.m., 10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to. At 6:25 a.m. on the 1st, how long for someone to be missing to inherit. At 6:34 a.m. on the 1st, can you throw away body parts?
Okay, I think we need Dr. Kendall Crowns, Chief Medical Examiner, Tarrant County, Lecturer, University of Texas Austin, and Texas Christian University Medical School. Dr. Kendall Crowns, thank you for being with us. Let me just ask you a couple of things, and I'd like to point out also, this is food for thought for you, Karen Stark, psychologist, on his son's iPad, like, they don't know how to read the search history, and there's daddy searching how long before a body starts to smell. How do you stop a body from decomposing? How to get rid of a body? 10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to. I'm glad he added, tacked that on at the end. How long for someone to be missing to inherit? That's not for you, Crowns. Can you throw away body parts? Okay, I'm starting to agree with Tom Ruskin and David Studdard that you don't really need the dead body to prove that someone is dead. Dr. Kendall Crowns, can you give me some quick answers to those? This is a lightning round for you. How long before a body starts to smell, Dr. Crowns?
4 to 10 days.
That just rolled off the tip of your tongue. I'm not going to ask why. How do you stop a body from decomposing?
Refrigeration. I mean, you look at that guy they found in the iceberg, Oxy, the Iceman. He was missing for 1,000 years, and he's stuck in the iceberg. So really, refrigeration is the best way to prevent a body from decomposing.
10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to. That's not a medical question. Let me go to the next medical question. Can you throw away body parts?
You have to, you know, if you don't want the trash man to notice them, put them in dumpsters, like which was possibly done in this case, and then chop, you know, dismember the individual into small enough parts that they aren't recognizable as human, and then mix them in with other trash. And another good way is to put them in, I think it's like these pool chemicals that can melt the body parts down into kind of a sludge.
You know, Dr. Kendall Crowns, you're actually
Nancy
scaring many people that are listening to you right now, putting it in pool. Wait a minute, Karen Stark, I know you've got something to add. Hold on. What did you say about pool cleaner, Dr. Kendall Crowns?
There's a certain chemical they use. I believe it's in pool cleaning or something else. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but it'll actually dissolve the dismembered body parts down relatively, and it'll dissolve the bone as well, and it'll just kind of make this kind of ooze, but then you have to dispose of that.
I'm glad you're on the right side of the law, Dr. Kendall Crowns. I really am. But guess what, guys? There's more. Take a listen again to Lynn Beeland.
At 9:29 a.m., what does formaldehyde do? At 9:34 a.m., on first, how long does DNA last? At 9:59 a.m., can identification be made on partial remains? At 11:34 a.m., dismemberment and the best ways to dispose of a body. At 11:44, how to clean blood from wooden floor. At 11:56 on the first, luminol to detect blood. At 1:08, what happens when you put body parts in ammonia? At 1:21 p.m., is it better to throw crime scene clothes away or wash them? Those were on the January 1st.
Okay, guys, just know that while some of these questions are so rudimentary, they are cruel and horrible. And three little boys are left without their mother while this guy is Googling, what does formaldehyde do? How long does DNA last? Can an ID be made on partial remains? Dismemberment, best ways to dispose of a body. What happens when you put body parts in ammonia? Should you throw away crime scene clothes or wash them? So to Dr. Kendall Crowns, lightning round, Dr. Crowns, how long does DNA last?
You can find DNA on surfaces for years.
What does formaldehyde do?
Formaldehyde is a fixative. Also, that's what you use to kind of pickle the organs. To keep them preserved for long periods of time.
What happens when you put body parts in ammonia, Dr. Kendall Crowns?
That one I don't know. That's a new one to me. As far as I know,
I stopped. You're out. No, don't go. I've got more.
I will.
One more quickie from Lynn Beeland. Listen.
On January 3rd, that same day, at 1:02 p.m., he did some more Google searches. What happens to hair on a dead body? at 1:13 p.m. What is the rate of decomposition of a body found in a plastic bag compared to on a surface in the woods? At 1:20 p.m., can baking soda mask or make a body smell good?
Can baking soda make a body, a dead body, smell good? These Google searches have led to a bombshell development in the search for Anna Walsh. Bob Ward joining me, Boston 25 News. An indictment. Explain.
He was indicted on three counts. There was murder, misleading investigators, and improper disposal of a body. So his case is being moved up from district court to superior court. Superior court has the authority if he is, when he is tried and he's found guilty on first degree murder, to hold him if he is convicted on first degree murder for life, no parole, which is the maximum sentence here in Massachusetts. There is no death penalty in Massachusetts. Nancy, can I just say one thing about the internet searches? And it's one thing that has just absolutely haunted me. When I go back over this timeline and you realize that there was a New Year's Eve party, that there were three people at this party. It was Brian, Anna, and they had one guest in the house, and that guest left the house somewhere between 12:30 and 1 o'clock in the morning. That first search, how long before a body starts to smell is it? 4:55 a.m. Anna Walsh was alive at 1 o'clock in the morning, and at 4:55 a.m., she's gone, and that search is done. And I just think about that, and I think that she's in the house. They also found, we haven't talked about this, in the district court arraignment, they said that they found blood in the basement, and they found, I think it was two bloody knives, one broken bloody knife in the basement, and a heavy smell of ammonia in the basement of the house. So, you know, I'm picturing in my mind that her body is there in the basement. He's killed her. And he goes and he finds his kid's iPad, and he's doing these searches within a couple of hours of his wife being there, someone that he loved. And this is what he is doing. I had a story. I broke a story about how he threatened to kill her back in 2014. And here he is in the first day of 2023 in the house with her dead body. And she isn't even cold. And he is already coming up with this plan on what to do with her remains. The depravity of this case, I've been doing this for 40 years. And the depravity of this case, to me, is really just off the charts.
The three children, the three little boys, now no mom and potentially no dad at home either. Not that it matters. Motive never has to be proven in court. But Bob, why? Why did he do this?
There's another detail here, too, and from talking to investigators. The New York Post had this this picture you all may have seen, and I talked to an investigator about this. There was a box of champagne from the party that the New York Post got a picture of that was on the dining room table. I went and knocked on the door before all this blew up, before everything happened. I was trying to talk to Brian. I did, when she was missing and we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into really, really early on. And I could see inside, and the Christmas tree was still set up and it was still lit. You could see inside. I didn't see what I'm about to describe to you because the police hadn't done their search yet. So they found a bottle of champagne that was still in its box, and the New York Post got a picture of this. And on the side of the box, Anna Walsh had written a note to Brian on New Year's Eve that said, "To Brian, we made it through 2022. It was a tough year, but 2023 is going to be a great year. Love you, Anna." And it had hearts written on it. And the investigator that I spoke to said they believe that was her, those are her last words to the world. And when I look at, there's another internet search here from December 27th. They did not describe where the internet search was found. So they didn't say if it was on the kid's iPad or if it was on a phone or a computer, but all it said was best date for a divorce for a man. So that's from December 27th, when Anna is still alive, before the New Year's Eve party. And it makes me wonder if whatever happened, whatever happened New Year's Eve, Anna never saw this coming. Just came out of the blue. I think because the story that I broke about the threat that she complained back in 2014 before they were engaged, they were just dating. She complained to DC police that he threatened to kill her in 2014. I think, and I know investigators think, that this is a domestic violence case and there's an escalation that started then. In 2018, there's a selfie picture of her where she's pointing at a bruise on her face, and she said that she fell at work or something. It's on one of her Instagram accounts. And I think there was an escalation of domestic violence. I don't think the police were ever called, but something happened, was going on behind the scenes. And this is going to be one of the things that I'm going to be watching for, to try to understand what happened here and how this exploded, because you don't get to this kind of, and this hatred to, I can understand a moment of passion, of murder, of, a moment of anger, but this dismemberment and this depravity that we see here in these messages that are caught on the iPad, and then what we've been talking about with the disposal of the body, it's almost too much.
The jury brings down the hammer, finding Brian Walsh guilty in the murder and dismemberment of his wife, 39-year-old Anna Walsh, the mother of their three little boys. He gets life without parole. Brian Walsh, rot in hell. Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend.